about large area modeling for particular effects.
Okay, thank you very much. Also, thank you for the invitation. It was for me an occasion to come back to Cambridge, which I think the first time I ever came here was last century, 1999. But still, ever since I've been back regularly. It's my pleasure to give an overview of what happens if you put stuff in a flow. Simulating a flow, a turbulent flow, is something that is becoming more mainstream. We know the equations, we have good methods, and we have large computers. So some can be done to good reliability. So some cannot be done. Oh, okay. Some cannot be not yet be done to good reliability. So that's why sometimes you have to blur the reality a bit, make it a bit coarser. Hence the word large eddy modeling. I'll talk about that in a little while, what that is, and how you can understand its reliability. After that, we'll have that as a tool, and we'll try to see what happens if you change the flow by adding particles. If you just add a few, these are tracer particles, you can use them for experimental observations. But more often, you could have a significant change, a modulation of the turbulence, just because of the presence of these particles. I'll try to say a little bit on what this modulation looks like, how you would incorporate these particles, and then how it's changing the turbulence characteristics. And if time permits, I will then switch a little bit toward an engineering application, which is heat transfer. I mean, you could put particles in there for fun. You can also see if you can benefit from their presence. So that's the recipe that I predicted. So I'm talking about this sort of situation, because as I will go into in more detail in a minute, you have basically two schools. One is point particles, so a particle is almost nothing, it's a point, and I describe its motion roughly following Newton's laws, and I can allow myself many of them. They will interact with each other and transfer momentum with the flow. The other, which I will not address much, is where you take this particular particle and just resolve the flow around it. It's not that it's not interesting, it's not something that I'm discussing today. It's much more demanding because you have to resolve flow around each and every particle, but it's not impossible. People do this. The drawback in that case is you're stuck with hundreds, thousands of particles in a flow, which is more of academic interest, whereas this sort of idea of point particles, you can allow yourself really huge numbers of particles and look at maybe large-scale preferential clustering and structuring in the flow. So flow and dispersed particles are what I'll be looking at, and how it modulates the turbulence by these particles. Or can I control some of the properties of a turbulent flow? Can I modulate it to my application? First, like I mentioned, I will discuss coarse and turbulence modeling and its reliability. So this is a short overview of large eddy simulation. Then I will look at what happens if you add a significant number of particles. And I'm looking at high volume fractions, but it's actually not that high. If you're not in this field, I'm just talking about 2% volume fraction. If you are in this field, you would say, oh, I'm talking about 2% volume fraction, which is a lot. The distinction is that with 2% or more, particle-particle interaction becomes important. If you have much less, you have an isolated particle, it's called one-way coupling. If the particles are affecting the flow, it's two-way coupling, but if they start colliding with each other beyond about 0.1%, you really have to incorporate that, and that's where large changes in the flow occur. So high volume fractions is not a granular flow, if you think of that, but it's putting it rather dilute, but significant in terms of particle-particle interaction. Because I like large eddy simulation, because it allows me an approach to much higher Reynolds numbers, I have to see what special challenges I have to face by incorporating particles in a large eddy simulation. So I'm trying to show the relevance of recovering small scales in a large eddy simulation. And if time permits, I will illustrate a few applications in terms of heat transfer. This is work that I did with a lot of people over the years, and here's some names for you. Maybe you'll recognize a few. Most of them PhDs, some of them respected colleagues. So this is the recipe. Let's start with coarse and turbulence. From Ricardo, I heard a little bit about your background, so I think I can go quite quickly on this. But course and turbulence, if you would look at a cyclone near Iceland, this is not a recent one, but we're under the influence of these anyway, you see many small structures. You see this large structure, but also all these tiny little details. And if you want to simulate this, there are estimates on how much this would cost, and the estimates scale, depending on how you estimate it, but roughly like Reynolds to the power 3, or 11 quarters. Which means if you want to increase the Reynolds number by a factor of 10, it costs about 500 times as much. Now, these days we have access to exotic machines, so once 500 is okay. But if you would now want to increase the Reynolds number by a factor of 100, it's not possible. So you go from your cluster to one of the biggest machines in the world to the end. There's no option there. So the promise of large eddy simulation is that you say, well, I'll take away all the details. The idea is that you still have a lot of information that might be relevant, but it will not be the full truth. So then the question is more, how much of this detail is needed? And now it becomes also challenging academically, because it's not just switch on a big computer, but also manage it in terms of approximation error and things like that. So it's a more academic challenge. Now, how to do that in terms of equations? Here you see in my notation, I use summation index, the incompressible Navier-Stokes systems. You have conservation of mass and momentum. And in order to blur the outcome, the signal, you can apply a convolution filter, which has a kernel G of a certain width. And you can apply that filter and get to something that's called the large eddy equations. Now, if this is a convolution filter, you have all sorts of commutation properties, which mean that the filtered field is still divergence-free, still mass conservation. But there is something different in terms of momentum conservation. You can see that there is still identical expression, an identical differential operator acting on the filtered solution, so the filtered velocity and the filtered pressure. But in addition, you get a divergence of what is called the subfilter stress tensor. So this replaces zero here. If velocity would be constant, this is actually zero. So if there would be no small scales, you don't do anything by filtering. But if you have many very small scales, this is a significant contribution. And it's also something theoretically difficult, because this introduces a so-called closure problem. I'm trying to predict U-bar, the filtered solution, but I would require, in order to evaluate this term, the unfiltered solution. Now, this is something magical, because it created a lot of activity over, I don't know, already half a century of people having suggestions. Oh, I think this would be a good idea, or this would be a good idea. There are quite a number of them, despite the fact that the idea was that this is a universal, simple modeling problem. Three famous ones I would like to highlight and illustrate a little bit further. You could say, well, turbulence on small scales is dissipated. Is dissipative. So what you could do, and the Smagorinsky model is an example, you say instead of having a term 1 over Reynolds times the viscous terms, you add something called the turbulent viscosity, and for it you use something that is linked to the gradient of the velocity, in this case the rate of strain tensor. There's a filter width delta that says how much you are filtering. Completely different idea is that you say I have something of a definition of the turbulent stresses, but I don't have the unfiltered solution. So what would happen if you would just, and this is a proposal by Bardina, the similarity assumption, if you would just say, well, where I would require U in my turbulent stresses, my subfilter stress, all I have is U bar, so I'm going to insert that. I'm not going to motivate it, but this is an observation. And there are many variants of this type of ideas. And you can, of course, mix these two. If you believe in this and also in this, why couldn't we have a bit of both? So you take a bit of Bardina's model, a bit of Smagorinsky's model, and you mix it through something like a dynamic procedure, which is also famous by now. It's, I think, already dates back to early 90s. And so the idea of an eddy viscosity model is basically a Prandtl mixing length that's a century old. Smagorinsky's idea is half a century old. I think this is 40 years old, and this is 20 years old. And these are basically as far as you can get heuristically. What you can do is also look alternatively and look at it a bit more mathematically and say, Navier-Stokes equations have too many details. Can I regularize it? And in this case, mathematical regularization should give me the subfilter model. So I'm not proposing it based on physical hunches, but I'm deriving it. And what you need to do in this case, instead of proposing a model, you propose something that's called a regularization principle. And in this case, I'm going to change the nonlinearity in my Navier-Stokes equations. Oh, they are there, they create all this beautiful dynamics. I'm going to change it, make it easier. And what I require of such a procedure is that after I accept such a regularization principle, I can derive the model, and the model should inherit some rigorous mathematics. So I will not have any problems about, is there a unique solution? Because I create models that have unique solutions, that are smooth, that exist at least. So all these hard questions that still are open for Navier-Stokes without filtering. Let's look at an example. Leray regularization. This is, again, very old. And it didn't have anything to do with turbulence simulations. Leray's proposal, or Leray's motivation, was to see whether he could prove existence, uniqueness of Navier-Stokes solutions. And he couldn't. But he could do it for something that is close enough. So you see roughly again what I showed you before. But now I highlight that I have a smoothed transporting velocity, u bar. And by itself, this is not an unclosed problem anymore. This is already enough. Suppose I would have a proposal u as an initial condition, and I have a filter, a bar operator. From u, I can get u bar. I can create the fluxes, and I get the next u, which I can filter again. I get the fluxes, I get etc. So this is already a closed system, not a closer problem anymore. So what you can do is you can play with this a little bit and derive the LES template. And then you can show that this particular model, the Leray model, is implied by this particular change of the nonlinearity. This looks a little bit like Bardina's model. What you see here is that you somehow need the smoothed Leray prediction, and you need to have some approximation of the inverse of the filter. Those are technical things, but that can be done. So this is a completely different idea. You say, I'm going to change some of the nonlinearity, and there are some other examples here as well, and I'm going to derive the model. So now we have the problem, who is right? So let's test the models, and in this case I'm going to look at something you could call a commutative diagram. The idea would be that if I have Navier-Stokes equations and I do a DNS, a genuine one, everything nice, I would have the pressure and the velocity predicted, after which I could apply my choice of filter, and I have the filtered representation of my solution. No tricks, that's all clear. Expensive maybe, but in principle it's easy. What I could also do is I could filter the equations and do large eddy simulation after I've come up with the perfect subgrid model and I have no problems with my numerics. And if all would be fine, which it, of course it isn't, going clockwise or anti-clockwise would be the same, would give me the same results. And in reality, this is not true, but it gives me an idea on how to test error sources because the model may not be perfect, or perhaps the numerics is not perfect. So let's look into this. This is a picture of Smagorinsky I could steal from the web. This is something, a picture of Leray. So now, how do these two lines work in practice? I take an example. In this case, I look at the temporal mixing layer, which I don't have to explain here, but what you see here is I'm just going to simulate this, and you see a nicely developing complex blob of numerical turbulence. This is what people can do. You can do a genuine DNS. I'll just give you one sample of a result. As you can see here, in a real mixing layer, the layer becomes thicker downstream, or becomes thicker with time. So this is the one quantity I'm going to look at. There are more quantities you can look for validation, but for this presentation, I just will have highlighting this particular quantity. So as a function of time, you see here the thickness of this spreading mixing layer. Now, fortunately, I have the truth. Because I did a DNS, I can do a filter, and the filtered truth are the red circles. So this is expensive, but I do a DNS, I take a top-head filter or a Gaussian filter, I filter, I do the post-processing, and I know what the momentum thickness should be. And all the rest is wrong, to varying degrees. Those are all subgrid models, which are much cheaper, but have difficulty. So for example, if you look at Smagorinsky's model, it has also a qualitative difference. It never really becomes turbulence. And so this is an example where a model is basically fine, but its intensity is not. It's too dissipative. Bardina's model, the other one that I showed you, is not dissipative enough, but you cannot really see that from this quantity. What you see here is actually the blue crosses are not too far from the red circles. What you can also have, and I would advocate if you ever do any LHCb simulation, switch off your model. That is this particular solid black line. That is without any subgrid model at all. So this would be a coarse under-resolved DNS. And what you see here, there are some models, Bardina's, and here's another one I'm not highlighting here, which are worse than doing nothing at all. So it's a strict test. I'm not saying anything about what is good and bad about the model. Just look at what the consequences are. And you see a few dynamic models, which are, for this particular quantity, as accurate as Bardina's model. But like I said, Bardina's model by itself is not dissipative enough. It has the wrong flow physics. I'm not going to look into that further. Anyway, but the dynamic models are actually quite accurate. So what about Bardina? What about Leray's model? What you see here, now the red circles became black ones, but this is still the point of reference. What you see here is that the dynamic model in blue has a little sensitivity to the grid I'm using. So there's a little bit of wiggliness, but that's basically it. And it doesn't get better, doesn't get closer to the filter truth. And so one of the best models on this scale has this systematic error. This is almost a grid-independent dynamic solution. It doesn't get better than this. Whereas the Leray model, if you give it proper numerical resolution, you see it improves from something like this dash-dotted line, which is on a coarse mesh, to something that is, at least for large time, for well-developed turbulence, almost indistinguishable. So this mathematical regularization in this case, it's very simple, clean, and it seems to work nicely. And it even allows you to go to this higher Reynolds number. In my introduction, I just mentioned that every factor of 10 costs you a factor of 500. So you cannot allow a factor of 100. It doesn't exist in this world. With this, you can, no problem. On modest resolutions, you can go easily factor 10, factor 100, even higher. Problem then is that you don't really have good reference data other than through experimental results or some scaling laws that are being adhered more precisely. But this is, of course, a success story of large eddy simulation. You have a clean mathematical concept, and you get a result that even for high Reynolds numbers seems to do a good simulation result. Is that the whole truth? Of course not, because we do this numerically, and we want to always either get the Reynolds number as high as possible or do it as cheaply as possible. Almost like a Dutch thing, eh? Can I get it cheaper? But I think it's international. So let's see what my computer could tell me in terms of error because of numerics. Unfortunately, I don't have any theory on this, but I have numerical experimentation that I can do systematically. For that, I use homogeneous isotropic turbulence. So you see here an example on two Reynolds numbers. One is rather low. Reynolds lambda is 50 or 100. And you can do a DNS in this case, which is similar to the mixing layer, and I can then confront it with my large eddy simulations. And for that, I do something out of the ordinary. This is work that was published in the last few years. What I'm going to do is, in this case, I'm saying, let's take Smagorinsky's model as an illustration. That has a Smagorinsky length, which is CS, the Smagorinsky constant times delta, the filter width, and H would be my grid spacing. So here you see something like how many grid cells do I allow myself per Smagorinsky length. So if I believe in the model, it has its own length scale, and I'm going to resolve it like I would do it with any numerical problem. And here you see the resolution. So basically this is euros or pounds or hours. This is how much this costs, the simulation. So what you would hope, for example, if you resolve this really to high precision, and you go to high numbers of grid points, that there would be a grid-independent Smagorinsky solution. Good thing is that you can now define a error measure for each of these dots, for each of these simulations. You can just do a carpet bombing with your computer. Now, I did this, and you get something like a fingerprint of your LES. And what you see is something like this. I will also show this as only one example. There's more you can say about it, but not today. What you see here is, again, here's the CS value, so the value of the Smagorinsky coefficient. Well, theoretically, I think it's even a Cambridge invention should be 0.17, something like this. But I just use it as a free parameter. And I have numbers of grid points, so rather coarse mesh to finer meshes. And vertically, because I have a DNS in this case, I can say how bad a particular LES is. I can look, for example, at the error in terms of kinetic energy. I can give you details if you want, but I think this is sufficient intuitively. Now let's have a look, for example, at the situation where CS would be zero. I would have, if I would increase the resolution, I would see the error go down from unacceptable, 50%, to almost DNS at 128 cubed, which is what you would want. You have no subgrid model, you just increase resolution, and you should converge to a grid-independent DNS. But you also see, if you would go to, let's say, more modest resolutions, you see that if you have no model at all, then because of the small scales that are not resolved, you get a large error. If you then add some Smagorinsky smoothing, you see that the error goes down abruptly and then moves up again. So here you have the situation where the Smagorinsky model is smoothing the flow tremendously, but also making it very inaccurate. So smoother is not better, it's just cheaper, or better numerically, but it's not more accurate. And what you would really want is to achieve this valley structure quite soon. Now in this case, you need to do all the simulations after you can show where the valley structure is, but you can also do this a bit more precisely, iteratively, and for example, do more than one large eddy simulation. So you don't do one simulation, but you try to combine a few smartly chosen ones to reduce the total simulation error. The way I did this is sketched here. So suppose I would have three simulations. It's a little bit like a bisection method to get a root for a function. It's a similar thing. Suppose I would have three of these, then on that basis I can erect a parabola, which would be the error as a function of CS, and I can predict what the next better CS value would be. So I can, at that next value of CS, do one more simulation. And I can repeat that until it converges. So what I do here, I take a fixed n, and then the valley structure is as you see here. And if I do that, for example, at Reynolds lambda is 50 or 100, at the number of resolutions, 24 cubed, 32 or 48 in this illustration, then what you see again is this cut through the valley structure, which I already have. But in this case, for example, let's take this example. This Reynolds 50, 24 cubed grid points, just as an illustration. If I have no subgrid model, I get a 6% error. If I take the CS value to equal to 0.17, a theoretical value, I get even more, 7.5% error. And if I take the middle, just like in bisection, I see a strong decrease, 2%. Then I create a parabola, I find the next minimum, create another parabola, and I can converge. You see some iterations here, quite quickly, and bring everything down to about 1% in this illustration. You can even have it better, 25 to 2%. But this shows that if you just have a few large eddy simulations at fixed cost, you can quite strongly reduce the error. So if you don't have the possibility to go to higher resolution, which is another strategy of reducing the error, this is one way of doing this iteratively. So this is a summary of my LES bit. I showed that there is a closure problem. I showed how I would propose to test some models. I could quantify a total simulation error, and once you can quantify it, you can optimize it. So we have this as a tool now. Let's see what happens if you put particles in there. Like I said, I would like to distinguish two. One is where you have particles where the flow around each particle is resolved. And this can be done up to these days. The world record is about 1,000 of these particles, where on big computers, modest Reynolds numbers, you can just resolve the flow and all the interactions that are there. The alternative would be that you go to much higher numbers of particles, but now the particle deserves or needs some modeling. And I will follow the right path in this presentation. I'm going to look at a very specific case. This is not a horizontal channel flow, but a vertical channel flow. There is an average flow coming from below. This is like a riser flow used in chemical processes. And gravity is pointing the way it's always pointing. And I'm going to look at what happens if I put these particles there in a computational model. Now, the first that I can do is I can look at what happens to the continuity and momentum equation. And now I have a local porosity epsilon, which because of have only relatively few particles, is close to one. But the porosity says if I have a grid cell, there are some particles in there. Not 100% is available for fluid anymore. Some of it is there because particles are there. So this is the correction you would get. And then to drive the flow, there is gravity and a pressure gradient, like you would always have in a periodic model. And then I have a new term, which comes from momentum transfer because of relative motion of particles on my grid relative to the fluid. So if this particle would sit somewhere in the grid cell, the relative motion, the momentum exchange, is transferred to nearby grid cells. You have different ways of doing this. I will not go into details, but this is how you would basically do it. So all I need is to know still how particles move. First I'll look at one particle, and then I look at how many particles would interact. This looks a bit scary, but I'll soon reduce much of it. This is a very famous summary of maybe more than a century of fluid mechanics research, where you see that a spherical particle with mass mp and velocity v would move as a result of all sorts of terms. Let's look at a simple one. This is gravity. One of those. This is Stokes drag. You have added mass, you have lift forces, you have all these things you may have seen at one point in your studies. Because I have heavy particles in air, in a gas, you can show that these are the dominant ones. So I have Stokes drag and gravity. Now this is easy, and here you need to interpolate a little bit, but because you can reduce the single particle dynamics to these equations, things get quite reduced in terms of complexity. In addition, because I allow myself high enough volume fractions, particles can collide with other particles, or they can collide with walls. And for that, I use something that's coming actually originates from the university where I work. Bob Homans did this originally 20 years ago. And it's just playing billiards. So the particles can rotate, they can move relative to each other, and you can just have a look at what their dynamics is. If you keep track of all the next collisions. Now that's the difficult thing to implement, it's the expensive part, but in principle you just play billiards with all these point particles. The main thing that makes it dynamic is something called a restitution coefficient. If I would have a ball, I drop it to the floor and it comes back, not quite at the same height. So every collision could be allowed to be slightly dissipative, losing a little bit of inelastic. So now we should talk about the regime, because if you have one such particle in a flow, well, you can simulate it. If you have many, you should see how much of the interaction you should incorporate. And for that, you need to worry about the volume fraction and the mass load in your system. And there's a proposal, a famous one by El-Ghobashi, where he says, depending on the volume fraction, he distinguishes something called one-way, two-way, or four-way coupling. One way, you're just an isolated particle and you're dragged by the flow and that's it. Two way, you have few particles, a little bit more in terms of volume fraction, but almost no particles. But they interact with the flow because their wake is created. They exchange momentum, and that's already significant. The one I'm going to look at is deep in the four-way regime, where you also have inelastic collisions. Here's an example of what motivated this study. If I have a steel ball that would fall in a bed of sand, then out of it erupts something that is hardly visible here, but you see a column of sand, a jet of sand jumps out. And what you see in a little bit more detail is that as these grains of sand fall back to the earth, because of the internal motions, you see these clusters forming. You see it's not, so here are many, many grains of sand in one of these clusters. So you see, on one hand, it is being perturbed because of turbulent mixing, and it is it's clustering because of the inelastic collisions. And you can simulate this. I hope I prepared this properly. So what you will see here is the volume fraction of, I think, about 500,000 particles in this channel that I showed you. And what you see is that so there are periodic conditions, so what goes out on top comes back. But you see also that in certain parts of time, all particles take the whole volume, and then because of inelastic collisions, they would come back to one big lump. Here's one cluster again that then gets spread, etc. So you can simulate this with large eddy simulation. And then you can ask yourself, how good is this? What happens to the flow because of adding these particles? Well, there are many quantities to look at, but for a channel flow, for example, you could look at the streamwise velocity, which is shown here in direct coordinates. And what you see is if you have no particles at all, you get the little circles. And the little circles are very close to, so you have the dashed line, which is on top of the circles, which is a clean DNS. This is available. Many people did such a study. And if you add particles, what you see is that the boundary layers become much thinner and that the height of this velocity profile decreases. So it becomes much flatter. And if you look at it in wall units, what you see is that there is still a von Karman, so there's still a log layer in the velocity field, but the von Karman constant has become much higher. So you can have, by just adding a number of particles at the right volume fraction and with their inelastic interactions, what you see is that they qualitatively change the flow. You can really change the mean velocity significantly by adding 1% of particles. You can look also at RMSs, or at fluctuations. And what you see, for example, so here again you see how well a large eddy simulation works. So the basic LES is very close to the DNS. But adding particles, what you see is that the streamwise fluctuations become much stronger, which we have seen. I mean, the velocity profile becomes quite flat, and you see actually a band of particles and no particles, band of particles, no particles. So there's a lot of fluctuation vertically in this regime, whereas perpendicular, you see that the fluctuations are reduced. So as if particles would move in sheets on average. You can also ask yourself, are you really requiring this high, this very expensive method, the four-way coupling? And this illustrates a little bit that the answer is yes. Because if you do four-way coupling from the same situation, two-way coupling, you see that this large-scale coherency doesn't develop. So where experimentally at similar parameters, you would see clustering forming in this flow regime, which you would qualitatively recapture with four-way coupling, you cannot do this with two-way coupling. Similarly, if you look at the difference between two-way and four-way and two-way coupling, you see that the two-way coupling is qualitatively different and also quite different from experimental evidence. Evidence says that the velocity profile should become flatter, whereas in two-way coupling, you see the strange center peak. So I can do a large eddy simulation, I can put particles in there to some extent. Now the question is, what is the role of small scales in large eddy simulation? Before I go into this, you can imagine a little bit of an inconsistency of what I did. Because if I have a small particle, it would move precisely following much of the small details of a turbulent flow. On the other hand, in large eddy simulation, I remove the small details. That's a bit strange. So if I have small particles and no small details to follow, they must behave qualitatively different. So my LES could potentially be very wrong. Now the idea is to see whether from the scales that I do have in my large eddy simulation, whether I can reconstruct some of the smaller scales to improve the dynamics of my particles. That's the story. Now reality. The question that came up was, how should I force particles in an LES so that they would behave or follow trajectories as if in a DNS? Wouldn't that be nice? You would get something more than you pay for. You don't allow yourself a DNS, but having an LES, can you enrich the LES so that the particles would move properly? Now, what you can do in this case is, because we have a DNS available, can we perhaps extract what stochastic forcing we might need to do this trick? And so that's the idea, right? We cannot really track the particles because there are not enough scales in the LES, but maybe we can kick them in such a way that effectively they would behave as if in a DNS. How to kick them, I don't know. But what we could do is just learn of that stochastic, proposed stochastic forcing from a DNS. And the goal, and I'll show an example a bit later, is that once you know what you should do, maybe you can come up with an engineering model. this would be the equations of motion if Stokes' drag would be the only situation, the only term relevant. So here's not even gravity included. And from a DNS, I would directly have this prediction. You see, so the acceleration would listen to the difference between the filtered velocity and the velocity of the particle. And here you see also the difference between the two. What I could do with something called approximate deconvolution model, I can improve the LES, so U bar gets a little star, which means it has some of the small scales reconstructed. But even then, there could be a difference between what I really would require. So the proposal is that I'm going to add some forcing. The question is, what properties does this forcing have, and can I find a standalone model for it? What I do in this case, I have a turbulent channel flow at fair Reynolds number. This is already a bit more involved. And I can just ask myself, what happens if I put particles in there, and I'm going to see the difference between a potentially filtered LES, all of this a priori testing, and the real trajectories. And what you can do then is look at PDFs of these velocity properties, of these stochastic contributions. And then something actually quite nice happens. You can just look at data processing and do data processing and see whether certain properties are strongly depending on Stokes' number and Reynolds' number or not. And in this case, you see quite a nice collapse, even though I'm varying the Stokes' number, so basically the responsiveness of the particles. I go from very small particles to very heavy, almost bricks, and what you see is that the PDFs collapse actually very nicely where it counts. So the first three or four orders of magnitude, they collapse really very precisely. And this is for the variation in the wall normal velocity, for example. You could also look with the same data, so I don't do any simulations yet, with the same data, you could look at what happens if the Reynolds number varies, and even there you have quite some surprise. A rather modest Reynolds tau of 150 and Reynolds tau of 950, if you plot it against a properly scaled variable, you see there is a beautiful collapse. So this gives the hope that you could get a simple standalone model for this. You can also look at relaxations, relaxation times, etc. I will not go into detail, but I will try to explain some steps towards such an engineering model. An engineering model is capable of predicting something, and the something that I would like it to predict is something called clustering of particles close to the walls because of turbophoresis. Here you see particles, and I try to sketch with my capabilities that there are more particles close to the walls than in the middle, which is physical truth. So my model should be able to capture that. Now let's have a look at what steps I could take in terms of developing this. First would be do nothing. If you don't have a good idea, maybe do nothing. That could be quite okay. In this case, the do nothing would be my approximate deconvolution LES. All I have is an approximate inversion of the filter, but no other model at all. This works quite nicely, but it also fails, for example, in high Reynolds number, quite heavy particles. What you see here is the concentration of particles at the wall as a function of time. And you see, because of turbophoresis, that more and more particles sit in thin layers close to the wall, as you would hope. So that's the DNS. If you have no model, you get a similar qualitative behavior, but quantitatively you are wrong by quite a factor. And if you would believe in this approximate deconvolution model, it's exactly what you want, but not strong enough. So we need more than this. If the Reynolds number would be low, this model would be perfect. But now we are a bit more ambitious, we go to higher Reynolds number. So what could you do? Well, I allowed myself this forcing, and I have some properties of it, and I'm going to just propose stochastic models for that forcing. First thing that I could do is just do a simple Langevin type equation, where I just say, well, the time variation of those kicks will have a relaxation and will have a stochastic noise term. And this C, this coefficient, actually has a relaxation time that you can also extract from the DNS. And so those are ingredients that I already learned, and I just see whether this model is any good. Again, at higher Reynolds number and even higher Stokes number, you see now the gap is closed. So the quantity that I want to get right, turbophoresis increase of the C-wall, is now captured nicely. Unfortunately, this is not the whole story. I have to be hand-waving a bit more. For example, if I take exactly this model I just proposed, but now for very light particles, so that very agile move with the flow, then you see that my approximation with the stochastic forcing is predicting this, whereas the DNS is predicting this. Completely wrong. Now, fortunately, there's only one more idea necessary. It's an idea due to Thompson. It's a well-mixed correction. So for the forcing, I'm going to look at relaxation, white noise forcing, and a well-mixed contribution. For example, taking care of keeping particles uniformly dispersed in a homogeneous isotropic turbulence. I will not go into details here. I just want to highlight this particular term. This is not due to Thompson. This is due to, well, me, us. It's a fixed parameter. I'm going to allow myself a bit of the old model and a bit of the Thompson correction. Maybe there's a need to make it dependent on the size of the particles. And we already know for heavy particles, I don't need that term. For small particles, I really need it. So what could I do? If I just add it, this particular term, you see what that before it was this result. Now you see the pluses hiding behind the DNS. So just doing this particular correction with that function, that factor equal to 1, is exactly what you would want. And if you now go to intermediate Stokes numbers, you see why I would not always include it. Here you see what you get just with the stochastic forcing. The DNS is the solid line, which is here. If I would just do LES with the approximate deconvolution model, you get something like this. So it's quite far, a factor of 2 wrong. Adding the stochasticity in this case doesn't really help much. It gives me the pluses, which sits here. So seems to be also not the right model. So if I do full stochastic model, it's here. If I do the Thompson correction, it seems to be correcting a bit too much. Now, what would an engineer do? Sit in the middle. In this case, by just doing some root search, you see that you get a fair collapse if F, this factor, is 0.6. Now, there's nothing special about 0.6, so what you can now do is just switch on the computer, be a patient, and just have a look at what happens with this function of the Stokes number for different Stokes numbers. So for heavy particles, I showed you already, don't add it. It's not needed. For small particles, you can add it fully. And intermediate, well, this is something that is nicely captured by this e to the minus half Stokes. So that would close this engineering model. In view of time, I will just mention that this can now be used for all sorts of applications. For example, you can intensify heat transfer by adding particles that would evaporate, that could all sorts of things. I'm not quite sure if you're really interested in it, I'll give you some more detail maybe after the presentation. But this is what you can now do. We have some reliable large eddy simulation. We know what happens if you put particles in there, even at high volume fractions. We can correct and improve small scales in large eddy simulation, and you can get quite a good prediction of this heat transfer intensification. It has all sorts of relevant applications, and all I want to mention is that you can simulate this quite accurately and see that you can get improvements of the Nusselt number by factors of 3 or 4. So if you want to hear a little bit of that, just let me know. I'll just come to my conclusions. As already mentioned, I was highlighting some recent work and some not so recent work on flow and dispersed particles. And I showed that turbulence can be modulated significantly by adding these particles. Course and turbulence, I think you now know a little bit more about large eddy simulation and why it is needed and how you can test its reliability. I showed how you can incorporate particles. I didn't show in much detail the real challenge there, and there are some examples of implementations in literature. The real challenge is to know which particles will collide next. It's almost like a molecular dynamic simulation. That's where additional CPU time gets burned. But if you do that carefully, you can do that with neighbor lookup tables, and you can keep the simulation time within bounds, so that you can actually do DNS and LES or four-way coupled simulations and see what happens with turbulence. For example, a big change in the von Karman constant just by adding particles. What I also did was look at specific LES challenges to recover small scales, and I proposed a working engineering model. What I didn't show was that can be used for studying intensified heat transfer. What you can do is apply this to many other situations. One thing that is a theme in my group in recent years is that you optimize something called aerosol dynamics, so little droplets of rain or whatever is in there in air. It can also have medical applications if you inhale specific aerosols. And then the beauty is that these particles change their properties as a function of the process they're in. They could, for example, evaporate or heat or water could condense on them, so they will grow or shrink and change the dynamics in the course of their flight in the turbulent flow. That's what I predicted, or that's what I presented for today. Thank you for your attention. No. What I illustrated was if I would have the luxury of knowing the truth. Actually, you need to know some idea of the truth or something that you prefer. So my illustration was the simplest one. You have a DNS, and you see how far you are in some agreed measure from the truth, and then you collect your simulations and see what happens. I would say in more general setting, if you did two simulations of the same problem, you have a preference. Now, so as soon as you can articulate the preference, you should be able to quantify the error, and then you can optimize.
But from your, say, three simulations, there's no way you would know which one's more correct.
No. This is I don't agree with that. Okay. The one that I showed, you have to distinguish what my example is and what the idea is. The example has a DNS for all cases. So I allow myself the freedom, I cheat. And then if I did three simulations, I know which parabola to erect, I know the errors, and I can move on to optimize. Now your question is, what if you wouldn't have the DNS? Then I'm saying, well, you should have something else. The something else could be experiments. Well, I did some work with Charles Manifold where we have access to homogeneous isotropic turbulence data. And we can compare against that. That's one source of, you can rely on your intuition. Some people are good at it, say, well, for example, if a numerical solution does this, and there's no reason, it's probably wrong. And if you can quantify little wiggles in the flow, which might be wrong because of numerics, you say, well, if I can measure them, I can try to steer away from it. So there's another way of doing that. And what I would say in more general is if you know which of two or three simulations that you did is best, apparently you have some built-in idea of what is what you want. And that is very specific to the applications. If you have a combustion problem, it gets very hot, and you don't want it to be hotter than something close to a wall, because otherwise the wall disappears. It's a very practical thing. So there you would have the wish to predict the maximum temperature with high precision, which is different from what I did here. Here I looked at kinetic energy. So depending on what you want, there may be scaling laws that people have, friction laws that are sort of agreed upon, etc. So if you know a point of reference, you can find the sweet spot. If you have no idea, I think that's also a bit unfair, because then how would you say that one simulation is better than the other? Which value? The one, the
CS is...
No, 0.17. I would say take the Book of Pope. It's a standard thing.
Is it comparing to experiments?
No. That comes from our brains. It's a scaling argument, and the 0.17 I think is coming from a production equals dissipation idea and an assumed spectrum of turbulence. And then you can quite rigorously show a value that in practice is quite useless. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, that's how it is. Exactly, exactly. They are
stochastic within, say, if you've got four particles within a box, within a small cell, you don't stochastically allocate the momentum again or reallocate.
No, I don't do that. It's what I do try is with this neighbor search is that I basically assume that there is only interactions at any point with two particles. So it is at high volume fraction but still at very low. If you would go really to the limit of granular flow, we all touch each other. That's not quite here. So here I still have the luxury to pretend that there will be no three-point collisions.
Okay.
And otherwise, it is not a point particle. I've given it physical size, but I'm not really resolving the flow around it. That comes from the two-way coupling, where I give some of my momentum to the fluid, which changes my motion. So there is a little bit of wake effect there.
Any more questions? So we can thank the speaker as well.
Okay, thank you.